welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and it's official. Summer has arrived. The calendar confirms the solstice. School's out for summer. Thank you, Alice Cooper. Whether we're headed for the mountains, the national parks, across the pond, or across the state, we're looking for that very special genre of book, the beach read. It can be fiction or a compelling memoir by someone on the national scene. The parameters are simple. The beach read has to be a page-turner, something you reach for when you have a quiet moment. And more often than not, it's a book your friends are talking about. So which title should you take along this summer? We'll preview some strong contenders, and we'll speak with Steve Barry, who's just out with a fascinating new thriller about President Lincoln. It's all ahead as we turn to page one of the book report. First off on the book report, another bestseller from Edgar-winning author Lisa Scottoline. Keep Quiet is an emotionally complex story about one man's split-second decision to protect his son and the devastating consequences that follow. Jake Buckman's relationship with his 16-year-old Ryan is not an easy one. At the urging of his wife, Jake goes alone to pick up Ryan in a movie theater. On the way home, Ryan asks to drive on a deserted road. Jake sees it as a chance to make a connection. What starts as a father-son bonding opportunity turns into a nightmare. Tragedy strikes, and with Ryan's entire future hanging in the balance, Jake is forced to make a split-second decision that plunges them both into a world of guilt and lies. Without ever meaning to, Jake and Ryan find themselves living under the crushing weight of their secret, which threatens to tear their family to shreds. Ron Livingston performs the book.
The girls waved goodbye, and he waited for Ryan to notice the Audi. He'd texted to say he was coming, but Ryan hadn't replied, so he couldn't be sure the text got delivered. Jake didn't honk, wave, or do something else dorky so as not to embarrass himself or suburban fathers in general. Jake saw Ryan slide his iPhone from his pocket and flick his bangs back, so that the phone illuminated his son's face. Ryan had large, warm brown eyes, a long, thin nose, and largish mouth, his handsome features framed by wavy chestnut brown hair, which he kept longish. Everybody said Ryan was the spitting image of his father, but Jake knew that was true too many years and 25 pounds ago. Jake was 46 years old, with crow's feet, graying temples, and a starter paunch to prove it. He always said that Ryan got his size from his father, but his brains from his mother, which was the best of both. Jake watched as Ryan looked up from his iPhone, spotted the Audi, and jerked his chin up in acknowledgement, then slapped Caleb's palm and came toward the car. Jake unlocked the passenger door, and Ryan opened it and slid inside, his jacket sliding against the leather seat. "Where's Mom?" he asked, eyebrows lifting. "She was busy, so I figured I'd come. How was the movie?" "Okay. You left Moose home?" Ryan kept an eye on his iPhone screen. "Oops, yeah." Jake hadn't thought to take the dog, though Pam carted him everywhere. He disengaged the brake, fed the car gas, and headed for the exit. "I guess you didn't want him to come. This car's too awesome." Ryan kept his head down, his thumbs flying as he texted, growing the blue electronic bubble on the phone screen. "No, it's not that. I forgot. I'll bring him next time." "Don't. He'll drool on the seats. We must keep the machine pristine." Ryan paused as he read the screen. "You mind if I keep texting? I want to stay with this convo." "Yeah, it's okay. Do your thing." Jake steered around the back of the King of Prussia Mall, where the lights of JCPenney, Macy's, and Neiman Marcus brightened a cloudy night sky. Cars were rushing everywhere. It was Friday night, the busy beginning to the weekend. It should have been colder for February, but it wasn't. A light fog thickened the air, and Jake remembered something he'd learned tonight from the pretty weather girl on TV. Fog is a cloud on the ground. He turned the defrost to maximum and accelerated toward Route 202, heading for open road. Ryan texted away, his hip-hop ringtone going off at regular intervals, punctuated by the apple-generated swoosh. Jake wondered if his son was talking to the mystery girl. He himself remembered racking up huge phone bills when he first dated Pam at college. He'd fallen for her their freshman year at Pitt and felt unbelievably lucky when she married him. She was a great wife, and he gave her total credit for Ryan being so well-adjusted and popular, despite his naturally reserved manner. He was earning A's in AP courses, got solid SAT scores, and was already being recruited by college basketball programs, some Division I. Jake switched into the slow lane, heading for the exit. He wanted to ask Ryan about the girls, but he'd warm up first. So, how was the movie?
It's good, like I said.
All right. Jake forgot he'd asked that already.
How's Caleb and Raj and Benjamin?
He wanted to show that he remembered the names.
Fine. Everybody ready for the finals?
Yep. Jake was getting nowhere fast. He still wanted to know about the girls, and according to Pam, the trick with Ryan was to act like you didn't care about the answer to the question you'd asked, or you'd never get an answer. So he said offhandedly, "By the way, who are those girls at the movie?"
Ryan didn't look up from his phone, his thumbs in overdrive. Pink and green bubbles popped onto his phone screen, so he was texting with more than one person, like a conference call for teenagers.
"Ryan?" Jake tried again.
"The girls at the movie, who were they?"
"Girls from school."
"Oh, friends?"
"Yeah." Ryan still didn't look up.
"Nice."
Jake let it go, an epic fail in the vernacular. He pressed a button to lower the window, breathing in the moist, cool air. The fog was thickening, softening the blackness of the night, and the traffic dropped off as they approached the Concordia Corporate Center. They passed glowing signs for SMS and Microsoft, then turned onto Concordia Boulevard, which was lined with longer-stay hotels. He'd eaten enough of their reception desk chocolate chip cookies to last a lifetime because even his out-of-town clients were in the suburbs, the new home of American business.
That was a sampling of Keep Quiet by Lisa Scottoline. Steve Barry is a Book Report favorite. We've had several great chats with him on the show. Steve is the best-selling author of 9 Cotton Malone adventures and 4 standalone thrillers. He has 17 million books in print, and his work has been translated into 40 languages. He and his wife Elizabeth founded History Matters, a foundation dedicated to historic preservation. Steve has twice acted as national spokesperson for the American Library Association's Preservation Week, and he is a member of the Smithsonian Libraries Advisory Board. Today we'll speak with Steve about his new Cotton Malone thriller, The Lincoln Myth. Welcome, Steve. It's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
It's great to be here.
The Lincoln myth has so much history to chew on. Some of it was very surprising. In the book's prologue, you clearly state that to Lincoln, slavery was not the issue of the Civil War. Rather, his main goal was to save the Union. And you quoted him, "If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it." That was really surprising.
It is, and he wrote that. He wrote that to Horace Greeley, the editor of the New York Tribune, in 1862, and he made that position very clear, that slavery to him was not the issue he was fighting about. He was fighting about the Union.
Right.
You have to understand that prior to Lincoln, the concept of an indivisible union, a union of states that could never, ever be broken, was rather relatively foreign. That was not something that people really believed was the case. Lincoln created this concept, and that's why at another part of the book it says that Lincoln fought the Civil War not to save the Union, but he fought the war to create the Union. And it was after the Civil War that we had this concept that the states are you can't break it, it's a union forever. But I don't necessarily agree with that, and I don't think the Constitution does either, and Cotton Malone deals with this issue.
Right. You called the Emancipation Proclamation a gimmick. How so?
Well, it didn't free anybody. I mean, we teach school children all the time that Lincoln freed the slaves. That is not true. Lincoln didn't free a single slave, not one. The Emancipation Proclamation only freed slaves in the rebel states. He had no jurisdiction over those. The states that he did have jurisdiction over, the Emancipation Proclamation specifically excluded them. So he didn't free anybody, and that's another one of the myths of Lincoln that we deal with in the novel.
Right. Much of the Lincoln myth centers around the Mormons, their early history. You imply that Lincoln had a special agreement with the Mormons. Was that true?
That is true. It is very true. Lincoln was the first president of the United States to actually read the Book of Mormon. We know that because he checked it out of the Library of Congress in July of 1862, and he kept it for many months. I actually went to the library and held that book in my hand. It's still there today. Oh. And then in January of 1863, Lincoln made a secret deal with Brigham Young, the head of the Mormons. And he said, basically, if you will not cut the telegraph lines and the railroad lines out in Utah, and you will keep the Mormons out of the Civil War for the South, I will not enforce the anti-polygamy law against you. When I came across this, I realized there was a novel in there, and so I wove the book around all of that.
And was that act that you just talked about the 1862 Morrill Act?
Yeah, it was the Anti-Polygamy Act that was passed in 1862, the Morrill Act, and the Brigham Young was not happy about that. He didn't want it enforced, and sure enough, the agreement was honored. The anti-polygamy law was never enforced by Lincoln in the Utah Territory, and the Mormons stayed out of the Civil War.
All right. Well, since we kind of got into the history first, tell us a bit about this Cotton Malone thriller.
Well, Cotton is, this is his ninth adventure. He's transitioning a little bit. In the past, Cotton always got involved in something because it was a personal thing. There was something personal that drew him in. But over the last few books, he's been evolving into more of a guy for hire. And this time it becomes even more clear that's what he is. And Stephanie Nail gets him involved. First off, at a very simple thing that eventually escalates. He meets a new agent, Luke Daniels. He's a young Magellan Billet agent. I had a lot of fun creating him. He was a lot of fun to have in the story. He'll hang around a while. He's going to be around for some other books. He was just a lot of fun. And then Cotton has to deal with something in this book he's never dealt with before in his entire life, an emotion that he thought that he was somewhat immune to. And it's the emotion of jealousy. And he has to deal with that with Cassiopeia Vitt. And it's something he has to come to terms with. And their relationship gets challenged in this novel.
Okay. There's something that runs through the novel called the White Horse Prophecy. Tell us about it. And was there any truth to it?
It was a prophecy that was part of Mormon theology. It was very prevalent in the 19th century. The church repudiated it about 40 or 50 years ago, but they still kind of hang on to it a little bit. It's an interesting prophecy. If you read it, it's dead on target in a lot of ways, which begs the question, it's so dead on target, was it actually created after the fact? No one really knows when it was created. I go with in the 1840s is what I go with. Most likely it was created in the 1890s. But it's an interesting prophecy, and it weaves into the story, and it fit perfectly. So I thought it a way to make use of it.
All right. There was also another theme that I kind of found very central to the story and enjoyable was Mormon gold.
That's really true. There's a lost Mormon treasure. It came out of the 1857 Utah War when James Buchanan sent federal troops west to kind of wrestle the Mormons back under control. Not a shot was ever fired in that war, and Brigham Young came out of that a victor. But in preparation of it, they melted down all of their gold bullion and sent it west. It disappeared in a wagon train and has never been found since. And when I heard about that, I knew I had to use that in the novel.
Tell us about the Danites.
The Danites are sort of a dark history in the Mormon faith. They were a reaction to the violence that Mormons suffered in the 19th century. They really were tortured and just terrorized horribly. You know, it was actually legal to kill a Mormon in Missouri for a while. That's how bad it was. And so the Danites were a reactionary group that came out of that helped protect the Mormons and helped retaliate against that. They haven't existed for a long, long time, but just like with the secret societies of the Catholic Church and other religions, for a novelist, they're too cool to ignore, so I brought them back for a little return engagement.
Steve, as I was reading the book, I felt that the plot central to the story, that of states, current states, seceding from the Union, might be based on a dissatisfaction with our Congress and its ability to get anything done. Might that have factored into your story at all?
I won't say that it didn't. It didn't sort of come into play a little bit. There's a great dissatisfaction in this country right now with the federal government. People are very frustrated with it. I mean, 125,000 Texans signed a petition 2 years ago that they want to secede from the Union. Just a few weeks ago, 80,000 people signed a petition saying they wanted Alaska to go back to Russia, for God's sake. Yeah, I mean, that just shows you how deep set it is around the country. The question of secession is interesting. We seem to think that a state cannot leave the Union. But, you know, when I started writing this book, I believed that too. I really did. But as I did the legal research and I did the historical research and I looked at this more, I don't believe that any longer. I think a state does have the right to leave the union. The Constitution is silent on this point. The 10th Amendment reserves rights to the states that are not given to the federal government. The founders were silent on this issue. Three states, Virginia, Rhode Island, and New York, when they ratified the Constitution, specifically left in their ratification vote the right to walk away if they wanted to, and no one objected to that. So I think secession is on the table, and I think it's the ultimate check and balance to keep the federal government under control.
You know, as always with your novels, you do such a wonderful job of blending actual history with historical fiction. How much research do you do, and how do you balance?
This book used around 400 sources, which is what I normally do, 300 to 400 sources. I go through them all very carefully. I look at both sides of an issue. I try to give both sides in a novel. This novel's not a message book. I'm not trying to make a point here. I'm just trying to entertain you. But along the way, if you can learn something about a subject that you may not know, have known a lot about and you want to know more about, then that's great. And I'm hoping that folks here will be interested by this question of secession and how it plays out and want to take a look at it more. I know I was, and you're going to get both sides of it in the novel as Cotton deals with this issue head on.
Right. During the writing process, did you have readers from the Mormon faith offering their comments?
I had one reader. She's an editor for Random House, so I was very fortunate that I had a practicing Mormon that works at Random House. She read the novel and gave it a thumbs up, and we made some changes. She suggested some changes. This is not a Mormon bashing book in any way whatsoever. In fact, I have great respect for that religion, and it's fascinating. It has played an integral part in American history, and I wanted people to know about that. So this isn't a Mormon take over the world book. It deals with their role in American history and their particular connection to Abraham Lincoln.
What's next for Cotton?
Cotton will be headed off on a new adventure next year. I'm writing it now. It'll be his 10th adventure. It'll deal with something from the Constitution. Very interesting. That's going to really, I think people are going to go, wow, I didn't know that at all. It's called The Patriot Threat. And if you want to know more about me or the Lincoln myth or anything regarding myself, just go to steveberry.org. Everything is there.
Okay. Steve, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, ma'am.
Alrighty. Bye. And now let's listen to a sampling of the Lincoln myth, narrated by Scott Brick.
Washington, D.C., September 10th, 1861. Abraham Lincoln kept his temper under control, but the woman standing across from him was taxing his patience. "The general did only what all decent people believe to be right," she said. Jessie Benton Fremont was the wife of General John Fremont, United States Army, the man in charge of all Union military affairs west of the Mississippi River. A Mexican War hero and renowned explorer, Fremont had received his latest command appointment in May. Then, a month ago, with the Civil War raging in the South, he unilaterally issued a proclamation emancipating all slaves of Missouri rebels who'd taken up arms against the United States. That was bad enough, but Fremont's edict went even farther and declared that all prisoners of war would be shot. "Madam," he said, his voice low, "is it truly your husband's view that any captured rebels be killed? These men must know they are traitors to their country, and traitors have always been put to death. Do you realize that once that is begun, the Confederates will shoot who they hold of ours in retaliation, man for man, indefinitely? Sir, we did not start this rebellion." The clock on the mantel told him it was nearing midnight. A note had arrived at the presidential mansion 3 hours ago, its message concise. "Mrs. Fremont brings to the president from General Fremont a letter and some verbal communications, which she would be glad to deliver with as little delay as possible. If it suits the president's convenience, will he name a time to receive them this evening or at some early hour tomorrow?" His response told her to come immediately. They stood in the red parlor on the first floor, a chandelier burning brightly. He knew of this imposing woman. the daughter of a former U.S. senator, highly educated, raised in Washington, D.C., schooled in politics. She'd defied her parents and married Fremont at the age of 17, eventually birthing 5 children. She'd supported her husband during his explorations of the West and was there when he served as military governor of California and as one of that state's initial U.S. senators. She'd campaigned with him when he became, in 1856, the first presidential nominee of the new Republican Party. He came to be known as the Pathfinder, and his candidacy had reawakened popular enthusiasm. And though he lost to James Buchanan, if Pennsylvania had voted differently, he would have been elected. So, for Lincoln, as the first Republican Party president actually elected, appointing John Fremont commander of the West had been an easy choice. Now he regretted it. He wondered if life could be any worse. The immense pride he'd felt in March, taking the oath as the 16th president, had been replaced with the agony of the Civil War. 11 states had seceded from the Union and formed their own confederacy. They'd attacked Fort Sumter, forcing him to blockade all southern ports and suspend the writ of habeas corpus. The Union army had been dispatched, but suffered a humiliating defeat at Bull Run. That crushing blow convincing him this conflict would be long and bloody. Now, Fremont and his grand emancipation. He could sympathize with the general. Rebels had soundly defeated Union forces in southern Missouri and were advancing northward. Fremont was isolated, with limited men and resources. The situation demanded action, so he'd placed Missouri under martial law. Then he'd gone too far, ordering the slaves from all rebels freed. Neither Lincoln himself nor Congress had been so bold.
That was The Lincoln Myth by Steve Barry. Everybody's Got Something, the new memoir by Good Morning America anchor Robin Roberts, recounts the incredible journey Robin's life has been so far and the lessons she's learned along the way. With grace, heart, and humor, she writes about overcoming breast cancer, only to learn 5 years later she'll need a bone marrow transplant to combat a rare blood disorder. We witness her triumphant return to Good Morning America after her medical leave, and the support and love of family and friends that saw her through. Following her mother's advice to make your mess your message, Robin taught a nation of viewers the ways to face a medical crisis, deal with aging parents, and how to deal with heartbreak in all its many forms. As Robin, who narrates, shares, it's all about faith, family, and friends, and finding out that you are stronger, much stronger than you think.
When we bought the house in 1975, Mom insisted on having a fireplace built in the family room. A beautiful stone fireplace that we never used. After all, it doesn't get that cold on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. But Mom always wanted a fireplace, and a fireplace we had. Mom was like that. She'd get her mind set on something, and that was that. For as long as I can remember, I've gone home to the past for the holidays. It's just not Christmas until I open the door and hear the little bell ring. I brought that bell back for my mother after I covered the Lillehammer Olympic Games. The jingle it makes when the door opens is one of the sweetest sounds I know. Mama taught me to always treasure a memento from my world travels. Our home in the past is filled with beautiful pieces, reminders of all the places we lived when my dad was in the Air Force. I welcomed in 2012 with Mama at our family home in the past. Usually when I entered the house, the first thing that greeted me after a warm hug from Mama was the aroma of something she was whipping up in the kitchen. Not this time. That was the first sign that Mama wasn't feeling well. She had battled illnesses for as long as I could remember. High blood pressure, heart disease, arthritis, and most recently, seizures. Mama had begun to suffer TIAs, transient ischemic attacks. That's when blood flow to part of the brain stops for a brief period of time. Mama would have stroke-like symptoms for an hour or two, but then, thankfully, return to normal. It was always so scary when that would happen. Mama wasn't the only one feeling ill. I was, too. I didn't want to worry her, but I had been experiencing a bone-weary tiredness for a couple of months. I kept thinking I'd shake it off or that I would be feeling better soon. I'd been through worse, or so I thought at the time. Plus, I had the Oscars to get ready for the following month. For the past few years, I've been the host of the Oscars Red Carpet Live. It's like the pregame for Hollywood's biggest night. Lots of glitz, glamour, and movie stars. In 2012, I arrived in Los Angeles feeling a little more tired than usual. Covering the Oscars is exhausting. I usually fly out Friday after Good Morning America. I stay at the hotel that is attached to the theater where the Oscars are held. This makes it more convenient to go to rehearsals for the show. Plus, I don't have to worry about wrinkling my Oscar dress in the car. I just walk from my hotel room to the red carpet. That year, I flew out to L.A. a day early to do a story on Yanni Curry. Yanni was told he would never walk again. A freak accident in the ocean in 2006 left him paralyzed from the neck down. His then-girlfriend, Susan, told me the doctor looked her right in the eye and said, "You need to prepare for him never to walk again." Before the accident, the 6'4", 285-pound Curry was a star defensive tackle on the Georgetown University football team with NFL prospects. His friends gave him the nickname "The General" for his take-charge attitude. His spinal cord was fractured in two places. During the 2 months he was in intensive care, Yanni developed pneumonia and almost died twice. Susan told me there were many times he said to her, "You don't need to do this. You don't need to be here." Susan told me, "I promised him that as long as his heart and his mind stayed the same, that I would love him." The couple moved to Louisville to work with Dr. Susan Harkema. She helped develop a cutting-edge therapy known as locomotor training. The late actor Christopher Reeve, someone I was fortunate to meet, was among her first test subjects. The training teaches the spinal cord how to control motor functions like walking by using repetitive motion. After 2 months of intensive training, Yanni had his first milestone, a little toe wiggle. And in May 2009, Yanni took his first steps in 3 years with the assistance of a walker.
We've just heard Everybody's Got Something by Robin Roberts with Veronica Chambers. As a child in small-town Oklahoma, Elizabeth Warren yearned to go to college and become an elementary school teacher, an ambitious goal given her family's modest means. Early marriage and motherhood seemed to put that dream out of reach. But 15 years later, she was a distinguished law professor with a deep understanding of why people go bankrupt. Then came the phone call that changed her life. Could she come to Washington to help advise Congress on rewriting the bankruptcy laws? Thus began an impolite education into the bare-knuckled, often dysfunctional ways of D.C. She fought for better bankruptcy laws for 10 years and lost. She tried to hold the federal government accountable during the financial crisis, but became a target of the big banks. She came up with the idea of a new agency designed to protect consumers from predatory bankers, and was denied the opportunity to run it. Finally, at age 62, she decided to run for elective office and won one of the most competitive and watched Senate races in the country. In a fighting chance, a passionate, funny, rabble-rousing book, Warren, who narrates, shows why she chose to fight for the middle class and why she has become a hero to those who believe America's government can and must do better for working families.
I'm Elizabeth Warren. I'm a wife, a mother, and a grandmother. For nearly all my life, I would have said I'm a teacher, but I guess I can't really say that anymore. Now I'd have to introduce myself as a United States Senator, although I still feel a small jolt of surprise when I say that. This is my story, and it's a story born of gratitude. My daddy was a maintenance man, and my mother worked the phones at Sears. More than anything, my parents wanted to give my three older brothers and me a future. And all four of us have lived good lives. My oldest brother, Don Reed, served 20 years in the military, with 288 combat missions in Vietnam to his credit. In good years, my brother John had a union job operating a crane, and in leaner years, he took whatever construction work he could get. My brother David, he had a special spark. He started his own business, and when that didn't work out, he started another business, because he couldn't imagine a world where he wasn't living by his wits every day. I went to college and became a teacher, first for special needs kids, and then for law students. Only much later did I get involved in politics. My brothers and I all married and had children, and my parents plastered their walls, their refrigerator, and their tabletops with pictures of their much-loved grandchildren. I will be grateful to my mother and daddy until the day I die. They worked hard, really hard, to help my brothers and me along. But we also succeeded, at least in part, because we were lucky enough to grow up in an America that invested in kids like us and helped build a future where we could flourish. And here's the hard truth. America isn't building that kind of future any longer. Today, the game is rigged. Rigged to work for those who have money and power. Big corporations hire armies of lobbyists to get billion-dollar loopholes into the tax system and persuade their friends in Congress to support laws that keep the playing field tilted in their favor. Meanwhile, hardworking families are told that they'll just have to live with smaller dreams for their children. Over the past generation, America's determination to give every kid access to affordable college or technical training has faded. The basic infrastructure that helps us build thriving businesses and jobs, the roads, bridges, and power grids, has crumbled. The scientific and medical research that has sparked miraculous cures and inventions from the internet to nanotechnology is starved for funding, and the research pipeline is shrinking. The optimism that defines us as a people has been beaten and bruised. It doesn't have to be this way. I am determined, fiercely determined, to do everything I can to help us once again be the America that creates opportunities for anyone who works hard and plays by the rules. An America of accountability and fair play. An America that builds a future, not just for some of our children, but for all of our children. An America where everyone gets what I got, a fighting chance. My story seems pretty unlikely, even to me. I never expected to run for office. But then again, I never expected to do a lot of things in my life. I never expected to climb a mountain. I never expected to meet the President of the United States. I never expected to be a blonde. But here I am. The story starts in Oklahoma, where I grew up, and it tumbles through a life built around husbands and babies and setting the kitchen on fire. I made my way to a commuter college, a teaching job, a public law school, and eventually a professorship. As I started weaving in academic research, I became more and more worried about what was happening to America's families. And the story shifted to Washington, where I picked my first public fight. In 1995, I agreed to take on what I thought would be some part-time public service for a couple of years, and I quickly got caught up in a battle over our nation's bankruptcy law. I know that sounds a little obscure, but underneath it was a clash about whether our government exists to serve giant banks or struggling families. The battle lasted much longer than I'd expected, a full 10 years, in fact. My own life threaded through, of course, with graduations and funerals and grandchildren of my own. When that battle ended, I picked up another, and then another and another, a total of 5 big fights in all. They ranged from fighting for a fresh start for families who'd suffered a job loss or a serious illness, to trying to force the government to be more transparent about what was really going on with the bank bailout.
We've just heard A Fighting Chance by Elizabeth Warren. As Anthony Doerr's All the Light We Cannot See begins, Marie Laure is living with her father in Paris near the Museum of Natural History, where he works as the master of its thousands of locks. When she was 6, Marie Laure lost her sight. Her father had built her a perfect miniature of their neighborhood, so she could memorize it by touch and navigate her way home. When Marie-Laure turned 12, the Nazis set up their occupation of Paris. Father and daughter fled to Saint-Malo, where Marie-Laure's reclusive great-uncle lived. With them, they carry what might be the museum's most valuable and dangerous jewel. The story moves to a mining town in Germany, where an orphan called Werner lives with his younger sister. They find a crude radio and become enchanted by it. As the years passed, Werner becomes an expert at building and fixing these crucial new instruments. It was a talent that won him a place at a brutal academy for Hitler youth, and then his assignment, to track the resistance. Increasingly aware of the human cost of his intelligence, Werner travels through the heart of war and finally into Saint-Malo, where his story and Marie-Laure's converge. Zach Applebaum performs the book.
The model is a miniature of the city she kneels within and contains scale replicas of the hundreds of houses and shops and hotels within its walls. There's the cathedral with its perforated spire and the bulky old Chateau de Saint-Malo, and row after row of seaside mansions studded with chimneys. A slender wooden jetty arcs out from a beach called the Plage du Mal. A delicate reticulated atrium vaults over the seafood market. Minute benches, the smallest no larger than apple seeds, dot the tiny public squares. Marie-Laure runs her fingertips along the centimeter-wide parapet crowning the ramparts, drawing an uneven star shape around the entire model. She finds the opening atop the walls where four ceremonial cannons point to sea. Bastion de la Hollande, she whispers, and her fingers walk down a little staircase. Rue des Cordiers, Rue Jacques Cartier. In a corner of the room stand two galvanized buckets filled to the rim with water. Fill them up, her great uncle has taught her, whenever you can. The bathtub on the third floor, too. Who knows when the water will go out again? Her fingers travel back to the cathedral spire, south to the gate of Dinan. All evening she has been marching her fingers around the model, waiting for her great uncle Etienne, who owns this house, who went out the previous night while she slept, and who has not returned. And now it is night again, another revolution of the clock, and the whole block is quiet, and she cannot sleep. She can hear the bombers when they are 3 miles away. A mounting static. The hum inside a seashell. When she opens the bedroom window, the noise of the airplanes becomes louder. Otherwise, the night is dreadfully silent. No engines, no voices, no clatter. No sirens. No footfalls on the cobbles. Not even gulls. Just a high tide one block away and 6 stories below, lapping at the base of the city walls. And something else. Something rattling softly, very close. She eases open the left-hand shutter and runs her fingers up the slats of the right. A sheet of paper has lodged there. She holds it to her nose. It smells of fresh ink. Gasoline, maybe. The paper is crisp. It has not been outside long. Marie-Laure hesitates at the window in her stocking feet, her bedroom behind her, seashells arranged along the top of the armoire, pebbles along the baseboards. Her cane stands in the corner. Her big braille novel waits face down on the bed. The drone of the airplanes grows. 5 streets to the north, a white-haired 18-year-old German private named Werner Fennig wakes to a faint staccato hum. Little more than a purr. Flies tapping at a far-off window pane. Where is he? The sweet, slightly chemical scent of gun oil. The raw wood of newly constructed shell crates. The mothballed odor of old bedspreads. He's in the hotel. Of course. L'Hôtel des Abeilles, the Hotel of Bees. Still night, still early. From the direction of the sea come whistles and booms. Flak is going up. An anti-air corporal hurries down the corridor, heading for the stairwell. "Get to the cellar," he calls over his shoulder. And Werner switches on his field light, rolls his blanket into his duffel, and starts down the hall. Not so long ago, the Hotel of Bees was a cheerful address, with bright blue shutters on its facade, and oysters on ice in its café, and Breton waiters in bow ties polishing glasses behind its bar. It offered 21 guest rooms, commanding sea views, and a lobby fireplace as big as a truck.
We've just heard All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. The night after the 4th of July, Leighton Carlson Jr. of Red Wing, Minnesota, finally got lucky. And very unlucky. Leighton had picked the perfect spot to make love to his girlfriend, an abandoned farmyard in the middle of cornfields. Nice, private, and quiet. The only problem was the smell. It was putrid, absolutely horrible, and so unnatural. So much so, Leighton brought it to the attention of the county deputy. When the cop took a look, he found a body stuffed down a cistern, and then another, and another. Field of Prey is book 24 in the Lucas Davenport series, so you know author John Sanford has a winning formula. The police called in Lucas Davenport when the body count was up to 15 and rising. As Lucas begins his investigation, he makes some disturbing discoveries. The victims had been killed over a great many years, one every summer, regular as clockwork. How could this have happened without anybody noticing? And will it happen again? Richard Ferrone narrates.
For Leighton Burns Jr. of Red Wing, Minnesota, a recent graduate of Red Wing High School, go Wingers, the moment arrived on the night of the 4th of July. He and Ginger Childs were wrapped in a blanket and propped against a tree of some sort, neither was a botanist, in a park in Stillwater, Minnesota, looking down at the river where the fireworks were going off. Fireworks were not going off in Red Wing because the city council was too cheap to pay for them. In any case, Stillwater did have fireworks. While intensely pleasant, this was not entirely a new development. They'd taken petting to a fever pitch, but Leighton was the tiniest bit shy about asking for the big one. Ginger had her hand on Leighton's thigh, where, despite his shyness, his interest was evident, and then, as the final airbursts exploded in red, white, and blue over the 100 boats in the harbor below, Ginger turned and bit him lightly on the earlobe and muttered, "Oh, God, if only you had some protection!" Until that very moment, one of the few people in Red Wing who wasn't sure that Leighton was going to get laid that summer was Leighton himself. His parents knew, her parents knew, Ginger knew, all of Leighton's friends knew, all of Ginger's friends knew, and Ginger's youngest sister, who was 9, strongly suspected. But Leighton, there in the park, wasn't organized for the moment. He groaned and said, in words made memorable by thousands of impromptu daddies, "Nothing'll happen." "Can't take a chance," said Ginger, who was no dummy, and for whom, not to put it too bluntly, Leighton was more or less a passing bump in the night. "Do you think by tomorrow night?" "Well, yeah." By the next night, Leighton was organized. He'd gotten the green light to borrow his mom's 3-year-old Dodge Grand Caravan, which had super stow-and-go seating in the back, converting instantly into a mobile bedroom. Leighton also had the perfect spot, discovered a year earlier when he was detasseling corn. The perfect spot had once been a farmyard with a small woodlot on the north side. The farm had failed decades earlier. Most of the land had been sold off, and the house had fallen into ruin and had eventually been burned by the local volunteer fire department in a training exercise. the outbuildings had either been torn down or had simply rotted in place. Still, the home site had not yet been plowed under, though the cornfields were pressing close to the sides of the old yard. A narrow track, once a driveway, led across a culvert into the site, and there were good level places to park.
We've just heard Field of Prey by John Sandford. Here's one you may have missed, but the book report believes you'll find Stephanie Ivanovich's Big Girl Panties a rollicking and poignant rom-com. Holly Brennan used food to comfort herself through her husband's illness and death. Now, at age 32, she's alone and weighing more than she ever has. Fate throws her in the path of Logan Montgomery, personal trainer to pro athletes. When he offers to train her, Holly concludes it must be a sign. Much as she dreads the thought of working out, Holly knows she needs to put on her big girl panties and see if she can sweat out some of her grief. Soon, the easy intimacy and playful banter of their training sessions lead Logan and Holly to some steamy workouts. But can Holly and Logan go the distance as a couple now that she's met her goals and other men are noticing? Katie Shore performs this charmer.
Holly could almost feel his disgust toward her radiating out of him, as if the irritated expression on his handsome face wasn't enough of an indicator. She gritted her teeth and stuffed a large, brown, worn-out-looking satchel under the seat in front of her and ran her fingers hurriedly through the rat's nest on her head before sitting in it. In an effort to create some extra room for herself, she moved the armrest up. Trying to appear casual, she took a deep breath, sucked in her stomach as best she could, and buckled herself in. "At least she doesn't need the seatbelt extension," Logan mused. He was a little afraid to inhale, recalling a fat woman he sat next to some years ago who smelled of hard-boiled eggs and rotten cheese. Tentatively, he drew in a breath. She smelled like baby powder and lavender. Distinctly lavender. He relaxed a bit, giving a small nod in her direction. He couldn't help but notice how white her knuckles got on takeoff. Her fists were clenched so tight against the seat. Curiously, she showed no other outward signs of fright. At least she didn't start wailing or get the vapors or do absurd tricks to take her to her happy place. But with a second glance, Logan realized she wasn't just gripping her armrest. She wasn't moving. At all. He took a quick look at her face to make sure she wasn't turning blue. She was staring straight ahead, eyes wide open, fixated on some focal point in the front of the aircraft. "Breathe, girl," Logan found himself saying. Holly blinked once, her face pale, and tried to inhale, which to Logan sounded more like a gasp. "I'm not so good at takeoff," she responded on an exhaled whoosh of air. "You're doing fine," he told her confidently and opened a magazine. "Thanks, Superman," she thought, feeling the plane start to level off. "Easy for you to say. I'll bet you can actually fly and are just on vacation." Once they were safely in the air and Holly's panic passed, she noticed how perfectly groomed he was. He probably got a haircut every 4 weeks without fail. His eyelashes were longer than hers, and he even managed to make a green polo shirt and jeans look dressy. His broad shoulders vied for space, much the same way her hips and thighs did. Only where he was defined muscle, Holly was just mass. She glanced down at the magazine he was casually thumbing through, Health and Fitness. Its pages showcased dozens of toned, firm bodies, much like his. The fitness models wore skimpy garments that appeared painted onto their flawless tan skin. They flashed gloriously white teeth as they stretched and posed before backdrops of waterfalls, pools, and cliffs overlooking warm, sunny beaches. There were pictures of people in that magazine who looked like Holly, too, all with the word "before" in big, bold letters underneath. She couldn't swear to it, but they looked like they were taken in front of grocery stores.
We've just heard Big Girl Panties by Stephanie Ivanovich. According to author Henry James, quote, "Summer afternoon, summer afternoon. To me, those have always been the two most beautiful words in the English language." Indeed, Henry, I'm with you on that one. And after the extreme winter we've just endured, I think you'll enjoy these words from John Steinbeck. "What good is the warmth of summer without the cold of winter to give it sweetness?" Readers, enjoy your beach time or wherever you can enjoy some hours relaxing and reading. If you haven't yet decided on a title, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining us today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.